Hello, I'm Luis Hernandez, and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Well, Tropical Storm Erica is moving toward Hispaniola. There are still a lot of questions about the path of the storm and what sort of storm it'll be by the weekend. Well, let's start off. We've got a lot of folks to talk to get an update on Erica, but first we're going to talk to reporter Wilson Sayre. She's over at the Emergency Operations Center here in Miami-Dade County. Wilson, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hey, Lewis.
All right. So Governor Rick Scott actually is there as well, and they made an announcement just recently. But what is the governor talking about today?
Well, they were waiting for the 11 o'clock update from the National Hurricane Center. And that most recent update says that the storm right now is moving further west. And what that means is that there's more likelihood of a wetter storm as opposed to a windier storm. But there, Governor Rick Scott was down here just to meet with the officials down here, make sure that everything is in order. They had a phone call with the other counties in the state to make sure their emergency management teams are ready and alert. And this morning, he declared a state of emergency. And really what that means is just allows the National Guard to start planning, emergency teams to start planning it. It opens up funds for those kinds of preparations. So 30 people in the National Guard have been deployed. They're in pre-positions. And Dade County is in modified level emergency mode, which means they're starting to just call people with disabilities, with special needs, to alert them to the state of affairs right now, and to make sure that they have a plan of action, and to just make sure that the county is aware of their specific needs.
And really, at this point, too, we're going to find out what the update is on the storm in just a moment. And we've seen the track, and well, we're in that cone of uncertainty. So there's a lot of questions. But if there's one message though that is coming from county and state officials, I mean, what are they telling people?
Well, don't get complacent. Even if they're saying it's going to be a tropical storm, not a hurricane, still do all the preparations. Still be alert. Monitor the situation and still get your water and your gasoline.
All right. That is WLRN's Wilson Sayre. Wilson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right. So I want to turn over now to Curtis Summerhoff. He is the Director of Emergency Management in Miami-Dade County. Mr. Summerhoff, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
All right. You know what? I'm getting a little bit of feedback. I could still hear you, but let's see if we can't clean up that line. Are you still there, Mr. Summerhoff?
I'm still here.
Okay. I'm getting a little bit of feedback. We're going to try to fix that line up just for a moment. I apologize about that. Again, talking with Curtis Summerhoff, Director of Emergency Management at Miami-Dade County. We're going to try to fix that line in just a moment. I want to turn over to Jeff Huffman. He's a meteorologist from the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, welcome to the program. All right. I'm not hearing Jeff. I'm sorry. I don't have him set up as well. Again, we're talking about Tropical Storm Erica and the fact that, you know what, looking at for an update on that, on the storm. We've been hearing from officials, though, again, say it is just a tropical storm. It is going to be passing over Hispaniola within the next 24 hours, but we're not sure what happens then. And we are in the cone of uncertainty. Now, what it could turn into a hurricane, it could stay a tropical storm, it could move east, it could move west. But I want to know from you, are you prepared? Do you know do you have everything that you need to get ready for this storm? Give us a call, 1-800, or excuse me, give us a call, share your thoughts with us. I want to know from you, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Again, you can also tweet us at WLRN. Find us on Facebook, the Florida Roundup, and share your thoughts. Tell us, are you out there right now shopping for your supplies? Are there plenty of supplies? I haven't been to a store yet, though I am prepared. Do you have shutters? Do you have a plan? Are you ready to leave the state if possible? Share your thoughts again, 1-800-743-9576. Are you taking this seriously? Are you taking the storm seriously? Are you ready for the storm if it's coming this way? 800-743-9576. By the way, I did speak to somebody last night who kind of didn't think much of the storm. And said, if it's not a Category 5, I'm not really too worried about it. This is a person, by the way, who's lived in Florida their whole life. Really? You think a category five is the only time you need to take it seriously? The only time that you need to worry? I've been through every kind of storm possible, and I'd say you shouldn't do that. Again, 800-743-9576. 800-743-9576. All right, I'm going to go to the phones here, and I'm going to start with Connor. Connor, welcome to the program.
Hi. You were asking, are we prepared and do we take it seriously? I'm a native Fort Lauderdale resident. I always take the tropical storms seriously. I started preparing on Tuesday, and, you know, even if this storm doesn't hit and it doesn't do any damage, at least now I'm definitely prepared for the rest of season. And even if nothing happens, then, you know, at the end of the hurricane season, there's going to be a food bank that's going to be the beneficiary of my over-preparedness.
Do you have any concerns or questions? Anything, you know, when you think about whether it's Erica or any other storm, is there anything that's at the top of your mind? And you, as you said, Connor, you've been here a long time. You know.
Yeah, well, my biggest concern for me, like I said, my parents taught me well on how to prepare. You know, I've got 20 gallons of water and enough food. My biggest concern for myself is just basically the lack of air conditioning. When the AC goes out, and it's just, that's the only concern that I have.
Anybody who's been here knows. Yeah, they definitely know when the power's out. You know what it's like, what it feels like. Connor, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it. And hopefully this doesn't turn into anything, but you sound like you're ready to go. Kenneth in West Palm Beach. Kenneth, have you been through a hurricane before?
Yes, I have. I went to school at the University of Rhode Island. I've also been through many nor'easters, but I think the complacency issue is a huge thing down here. I've gotten warnings in my building, emails, and no one's moved any of their furniture off their decks yet. And, you know, just little things like that.
Universal time.
Yeah, no doubt. Kenneth, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate that. Yeah, no doubt. And like I said, I was just out and about in downtown Miami last night talking to a young woman. Asked her, are you ready for the storm? She goes, if it's not a Category 5, I'm not worried. I don't understand that train of thought. I've been through every type of hurricane, Category 1 through 5. And, you know, I can tell you right now, I don't understand that train of thought. Again, you can tweet us at WLRN. You can also find us on Facebook, The Florida Roundup. Somebody did tweet us. A woman at Home Depot in North Miami says she's not getting ready for Erica. She says the storm is hype. She's shopping for plants. You know, I would also remind folks, too, of Hurricane Jean. If you don't remember the path of Jean, what did Jean do? Jean was up along the east coast of Florida, and then all of a sudden it did a 90-degree turn out into the Atlantic, and then a 180 came right back and smacked right into Florida. Storms don't follow clean paths. It could do whatever it wants. All right, let's go back to the phones. I'm going to go to Joyce in Coconut Grove. Joyce, welcome to the program. Is this hype?
No. I mean, I've lived here my whole life and gone through all the storms, but, you know, you prepare June 1st like they tell you to do, and then you don't have to worry about it.
You know what? You've been through a storm, right, Joyce?
I've been through many.
What's the most memorable one?
Andrew.
Yeah, I was here for that, too.
And I was prepared. I was prepared, totally prepared. I didn't have a problem at all, but what I worry about is the other people that refuse to do anything.
You know something?
And then they create lines to get free water. It's ridiculous.
You know, Joyce, I'm talking about the fact that we haven't been hit by a storm in 10 years. In that 10 years, a lot of people have moved to the state of Florida who have never been through a hurricane. I'm wondering, do you run into any of those folks? Do you talk to them? What do you tell them about getting ready?
I tell them to get ready. I tell them June 1st is when you start thinking about it. You get your pet food and you have enough to survive on for, you know, 2 weeks, because you never know. Even though this is Category 1, we could lose power. And without power, you don't have a lot of things. So why not just get ready and don't have to worry about it? Right now I'm driving, and there's so many accidents. People are driving like maniacs. They're at the gas stations getting, you know, gas. And, you know, it's time to do that. But don't do it at the last minute.
All right, Joyce, thank you for that. And, again, very good advice. You know what? If you didn't get ready in this weekend, you're going to go to. Hopefully there aren't any lines at the stores, but just at least get the basics so that you're ready. All right, I believe that we do have Jeff Huffman now. He's, again, meteorologist from the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, are you there?
I'm not able.
All right, I can hear Jeff, but I don't know if he can hear me.
Julie.
All right. So Jeff is there, but we're having a connection problem. Again, apologize about that.
I can hear you now, Lewis.
All right, Jeff, how are you doing?
I think you were hearing me and I wasn't hearing you, so I'm doing well. How are you, sir?
All right, doing fine. So, okay, what's the latest on Tropical Storm Erica?
Well, as you've heard and as you've been mentioning, the actual center of the storm may indeed track to the west of Miami, and we are looking at more of a tropical storm-type threat as opposed to a full-blown hurricane threat. So, obviously, the concern is lessening for wind and surge and increasing a bit for heavy rain, especially if Erica were to slow down. I think the slowing down of the storm may occur a little further to the north into central and northern Florida, but overall, even though there's been significant shifts in those model lines back and forth, north, west of Miami, east of Miami, the general idea that we have a tropical cyclone headed for South Florida, whether it be a storm or hurricane, has been the case now for a couple of days. But the latest, as you know, I was just looking at the satellite picture with the center of Erica. It's trying to flare up a bit in terms of thunderstorms, moving very close now to the Dominican Republic. But obviously, it has literally a huge mountain to climb, if you will. It's a very mountainous island of Hispaniola, and we're not expecting any further strengthening in the next 24 hours. However, when it emerges north of the islands, of course, some strengthening could occur, but I think its further westward track right now is certainly better news for South Florida, but we're not in the clear yet and still going to watch it closely.
Jeff, when I look at the charts, I mean, Florida's enveloped by the cone of uncertainty, but help us understand how that cone is determined.
At each point, day 1 through 5, we base the cone, or the hurricane center, rather, bases the cone on previous forecast, basically verifications. And at each one of those points, there's an average error. And as you go out in time, of course, the error gets larger. At day 4, it's 180 miles, 150 miles, and day 5, it's over 200 miles. So now, obviously, for Miami now, we're looking at a day 2 to day 3 event. So confidence is growing a bit on that track in the day 2 to day 3 time frame, but still it's a bit uncertain if you look further up the peninsula, whether it moves up the west side, the east side, or right up the center.
You know, not to be the devil's advocate here, or maybe I want to, but I did mention Hurricane Jeanne, and I remember in 2004, that storm did this strange loop out in the Atlantic. It did this strange turn and came back around. You thought it was going to go away, and then it hit us. And so just storms don't follow clean paths. You just don't know what it's going to do.
Yeah, there's two things that we have to consider. Until you get a center of circulation that's mature and you can really understand the steering pattern behind that, you really can't formulate a forecast with certainty as to where it's going to go. And then on the other side of that, once it is mature, sometimes it can try to control its own environment around it. And if the steering currents are really, really weak, basically a tropical cyclone or tropical storm or hurricane can kind of go where it wants. It meanders about or just, you know, becomes stationary. It is possible, I'm glad you asked this, because it is possible that Erica could be something we are still talking about Wednesday or Thursday of next week, potentially in North Florida, Southeast Georgia.
Now, we talk about Tropical Storm Erica coming up on Monday and what it might mean for South Florida, but what are some of the factors that could either weaken or strengthen that storm between now and then?
I just spoke to the Hurricane Center actually about an hour ago, and I want to remind everyone there is still the possibility, on the positive side of things, there's still the possibility that it could degenerate into a tropical wave. It still has to go through not only the mountainous island of Hispaniola, but some really strong winds aloft. If it were to survive that, then we are looking at a small and somewhat smaller window of opportunity for strengthening between Cuba and South Florida. So it is possible that Erica could be a formidable tropical storm as it moves toward the state. One thing to note, because it's moving on a more westward track, the atmosphere conditions are not as favorable for strengthening as if it were to moving through the Bahamas. So that is certainly working in our favor for less of an impact at this point.
And, you know, just to finish up, so we have Tropical Storm Erica that we're watching. Is there anything else going on in the Atlantic right now?
No, but the remnants of Erica, if it does degenerate into a wave, could team up with an area of low pressure in the Gulf and certainly soak our state for several days, which I know for South Floridians is somewhat good news. But there's a few other waves out there behind Erica, but as of right now, no future development expected with those.
And Jeff Huffman is a meteorologist from the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, thanks so much.
You got it.
All right, again, you know, so as we get ready, as we've heard, we are on the cone of uncertainty, but that could mean anything. And we've heard from some of the callers, some of the folks here in South Florida, they've been through storms before. If you've never been through a hurricane, take it seriously. Get at least some of the basics if you haven't already, but have a plan. Talk to someone who's been through one. Believe me, tropical storm or hurricane category fives are not the only ones that you should worry about. All right, we're going to be talking about more hurricane stuff, but let's change it up a little bit. Hurricanes and politics, how about that? So coming up on the program, Jeb Bush and his brother, former President George W. Bush, forever linked to hurricanes. One is touting his successes, though. That's coming up on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. All right, so where were you in 2004 and 2005? Do you remember these names? Charlie, Francis, Ivan, Jean, Wilma? You know, those storms took a toll on everybody's properties and, of course, on our nerves. Jeb Bush was the governor back then.
Local officials will let you know when it's safe to return to your homes. Many people have taken advantage of our shelters, for which we are appreciative. Conditions outside continue to be dangerous, and they will remain that way even after the storm has passed. Please stay hunkered down and let emergency officials do their jobs.
That was Bush in 2005 in the wake of Hurricane Wilma. Now the former governor is about to publish an e-book as he runs for the Republican presidential nomination. And in that e-book, he touts his experience dealing with hurricanes. It's counter to the criticism that his brother, former President George W. Bush, received for the handling of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Well, joining us now is Patricia Mazet. She's the Miami Herald politics reporter. Patricia, always a pleasure.
Hey, how are you?
And Adam C. Smith is a politics editor at the Tampa Bay Times. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
You know, Patricia, the former governor is releasing this book, but he's released a chapter, I believe, of the e-book. It's about 2004, and that, of course, was the year we got slammed by four storms in 6 weeks. But what do we learn about the governor and how he dealt with those storms in this book, in this chapter?
Well, what the chapter shows is what everyone who worked with Bush will tell you, which is he was addicted to email, and he liked to interact not only with his staff, but also with people, constituents, residents of Florida who like to email him. And on hurricanes, he certainly got a lot of email, people asking him everything from, you know, what are you guys doing to prepare for Storm X, or thanking him for the work that they did. Of course, those thank you emails are the ones that are featured in the book because he wants to paint himself in a positive light. And to be fair, it is hard to find people who will criticize Jeb Bush's management of the storms, though you will find people who really disagreed with his stance on other things like insurance policy.
You know, I'd imagine that, Patricia, that there are two messages here. So when he writes this book, that there's one message for Floridians, which may be just a reminder of what he did or didn't do when he was governor, and then the rest of the nation, right? I mean, how is he touting the way he handled storms to the rest of the nation?
Well, the rest of the nation remembers Katrina in Louisiana, and there's a different Bush that comes to mind there. It's President George W. Bush, and people don't remember that storm being handled well at all by the federal government. So here, Jeb Bush is trying to contrast himself with his brother, and he's going to do it carefully because he's a big defender of his brother's administration. But he is trying to tell the rest of the nation, hey, I'm the guy you saw on TV in Florida where we didn't have those problems that you saw in New Orleans.
Yeah, and is that going to be a problem for him, or do you see this being a problem for Jeb Bush if he starts talking about hurricanes? You know, the fact that they're going to say, well, wait a minute, your brother, FEMA, Katrina, that was a mess.
I think they might, but because his record in Florida is so strong on the hurricane front, this is actually one of those places where Jeb Bush, I think, tried to tell people, hey, this is the kind of leader that I was on the ground, which was someone who was on top of things. And, you know, one of the staffers I spoke to at the time said, as governor, Jeb Bush used to catch mistakes in reports that they would send to him by email. He'd read all the way through and he would catch a typo in the data in the spreadsheet. So he was a guy who was hands-on without a doubt.
Well, if you're around during Jeb Bush's governorship, what do you recall about how he handled all of those storms? You can give us a call, 800-743-8255. 9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Find us on Facebook, the Florida Roundup. Share your thoughts. Did he do a good job? Did he handle those storms well? Or do you disagree with that? Adam, let me turn over to you. How do we grade Jeb Bush's handling of all those storms, especially in 2004?
You know, I think most people give him an A in Florida. And it's hard enough to be a Bush, to be running when people are looking for change and a departure from the status quo when your last name is Bush. But it's especially hard when we're heading into the 20th anniversary of Katrina. So that there's no the timing is absolutely clear why he's putting this book out now. And I think one of the reasons most Floridians remember Bush so fondly, even though he had a often polarizing agenda, is because of his handling of those hurricanes. And it transcended partisan politics, and it was an absolute competence, and it was a stark departure from the way the other Bush handled Katrina.
Who dubbed him the hurricane governor, or is this something he's putting on himself?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's probably everybody viewed him so strongly then. It was a natural thing for a lot of pundits and a lot of newspaper headliners and radio pundits to talk about.
And you know, I'm wondering, too, is there any one moment, whether it was in 2004 or 2005, that really solidified Bush's legacy as the hurricane governor? Was it one storm?
You know, I think there were a lot of moments, but I'll just say, personally for me, I think that image of the first time we've seen a governor talking both in English and Spanish, he truly looked like a governor that was everybody's governor, and he looked like something that was new and different and really connecting with all of Florida's many different people.
You know what? Is this the first time that a candidate, I'm trying to recall if a candidate's ever come out with an e-book? Because look, we know candidates, especially this time of year, are going to start coming out with books. But an e-book, is this new?
No, I think it's just it's easier to put out an e-book. I don't think it's going to be selling a lot. I don't think it's going to be helping his bottom line. But I think it's a natural, quick, and easy thing to do without actually going through the rigmarole and the cost of actually putting out a binder book that very few people are likely to buy anyway.
Patricia, what are your thoughts on this? Why an e-book? And what do we expect the rest of the book is going to tell us?
Well, it's a strange kind of a biography in that it is not as a memoir. It is a series of emails with introductions or explanations by Bush, and it's grouped year by year through his two terms in Tallahassee. So it's intended to do a few things. One of them is draw a contrast with Hillary Clinton, who is going through all this trouble with her private email server while she was Secretary of State. And the release of the emails in batches by the State Department and whether any of this was classified. And here you have someone who was ahead of his time, frankly, in terms of embracing email, but also who has made them public. Not all of them, it should be said. And Jeb Bush had private email as well, but the difference was that, of course, everybody knew it at the time. So that's one of the things he's going to try to do, try to paint himself as transparent and different from Clinton, and he still gives out his email address, you know, on the stump as president. So he's trying to show that he is accessible and not scared to engage in the kind of parroting that some candidates, like Clinton, don't like to do too much with, get confrontational with constituents or reporters.
You know, Adam, looking at the numbers, and we've got a long time before we even get to the nomination, but you can't help it. You have to look. Right now, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio are still trailing in this state, in their state, to Donald Trump. Can we figure out why?
Boy, if you can figure it out, the whole Donald Trump phenomenon, please tell me, because I am stumped. I have no idea how this ends or where it's going. I would have never thought Donald Trump was really going to gain. I'm not entirely surprised he gained the steam he did, but I was entirely surprised he kept going and is continuing to keep going. So, you know, he is a phenomenon, and he is connecting with people, and Florida represents the country. Florida is really a microcosm of the country, so what's happening elsewhere is happening here, too.
And do you believe that this state is still going to be key in this presidential race?
I do. I remember this is a battle for delegates and oftentimes also momentum. And so you really do have a scenario where whether it's Trump or somebody else wins the caucuses in Iowa. Jeb Bush does not win New Hampshire. He might do okay in Nevada. South Carolina could go somewhere else. And so Florida was widely seen as the firewall for Jeb. The Republican legislature did a winner-take-all for the delegates. And as we're sitting here today, it's possible that could come back and all those delegates could go to Trump. It could be a complete backfire.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576. We have a few moments here in the segment and love to hear from you. If you were around in 2004, 2005, what are your thoughts on how then-Governor Jeb Bush handled the storms, handled all of the storms of 2004, or handled Hurricane Wilma in 2005? Was he the hurricane governor? Also, your thoughts, too, is this. Why is he trailing in his own state? Or House Senator Marco Rubio? Both of them are trailing Donald Trump. 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Find us on Facebook, maybe, if you're sitting at your computer at work right now. The Florida Roundup. Find the group and post your thoughts and your comments. Patricia, when we I just wanted to go back real quickly, too, to this idea of the hurricane governor. What did we learn during those storms? What's changed maybe, and this may go to what Jeb Bush's legacy is, what changed in the way the state handled hurricanes, considering what we went through?
Well, I think the folks from that administration would tell you that they learned they had to be more prepared than they were at the beginning of 2004. I mean, this was a constant barrage of storms that they dealt with, so they ended up talking about preparedness at the state agency head level on a weekly basis, just because the state is so large that moving supplies and equipment from one corner of the state to another requires logistics and organization that you just can't do overnight. And we have seen in all these years that we haven't had a storm that the state has continued to have a lot of hurricane exercises, they call them, which is where they do run-throughs of what they would do in a hurricane scenario. And when you talk to, like I spoke to a Florida International University professor recently who studies emergency management, and he said, you know, Florida is still the best state in the U.S., bar none, to deal with a hurricane just because we are more used to it. We have more money set aside for it, and that just puts the state in better shape. And that was true even before Jeb Bush became governor. I mean, after Andrew hit Miami in 1992, the hard lessons really started to sink in, starting with, you know, we have to have a stronger building code. And they did that over the years and reinforced it after Charlie in 2004.
All right, I want to go to the phones real quickly and get a couple of calls in here. I'm going to start with Angel in Miami. Angel, Angel, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Well, I've been, I'm a an expatriate from Cuba. Got here to the United States in 1960, so I've had my share of hurricanes,
Andrew. Yeah, you've been through
and,
a lot.
And basically what you need to do is have three things ready, okay? Water and food. Ready, and I'm talking about the whole year. Water and food. Your shelter, your house has to be or needs to be, or your condo, whatever, needs to be basically hurricane, kind of hurricane proof. If you don't have, you know, shutters, or the shutters need to be ready, or your windows need to be hurricane proof. Okay.
And
the third thing, a generator. And the third thing, the generator.
Yeah.
If you live in a condo, it's kind of hard to have a generator. But otherwise, you just make sure that you have a nearby shelter. That's it. Those three things all year round, because you never know when things are going to get rough.
And you've been through enough, so you definitely know. I appreciate the call and a reminder to everybody. Take it seriously and have a plan. I'm going to go take one more call here if I can real quickly. I'm going to go to Linda in Boca Raton. Linda, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much. I'd like to encourage everyone to turn their air conditioning down as cool as they can stand it. So if we lose power, the house will stay cooler.
Haven't heard that one, but there's an idea for you. Linda, thanks so much for that one. Still getting some ideas coming through. People just want to share their thoughts on how to prepare. People who've been through storms, listen to them because they know. And of course, I'll just keep reminding you as well. All right. So I believe that, you know what, we lost Adam. I believe that Adam is out again. We were talking to Adam C. Smith. He's the politics editor at the Tampa Bay Times, and still talking to Patricia Mazzei, Miami Herald politics reporter. Before we finish up the segment, though, Patricia, just wanted to just go back to this idea. So Jeb Bush is coming out with his ebook. It comes out later in October. He's released a chapter, and it was the chapter of the 2004 year that he was in office, a lot of it dealing with the hurricanes. And again, I can't verify if this is the first time a candidate, at least that I know of, has released an ebook. But do you get the sense that candidates are just trying to find different ways to get the message out besides just writing a book or having somebody write a book, that they've got to find different ways to reach their voters?
Yeah, but I think Adam was right when he said earlier, it's not like there is a huge audience for some of this material. I mean, main audience is people like me, political reporters. So it is a way to try to reach voters and to be able to say in your speech, like, I have done this, and you can go read it if you want to. But, you know, candidates are still going to have to do the campaigning that they've done in the retail states, you know, like in New Hampshire where they shake every hand. And then just go on television, which is frankly where most people see which candidates they like.
All right, Patricia, stick around with us because we're going to switch from hurricanes. We're going to keep talking about politics here in just a moment. Coming up after the break, Donald Trump kicked Fusion anchor Jorge Ramos out of a press conference. The headlines say Trump is losing the Hispanic vote. But what exactly is the Hispanic vote? We're going to have that coming up on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. All right, so a few days ago, Fusion anchor Jorge Ramos and presidential candidate Donald Trump had a verbal scuffle during a press conference.
Okay, who's next? Yeah, please. Excuse me, sit down. You weren't called. Sit down. Sit down. Sit down. Go ahead. No, you don't. You haven't been called. Go back to Univision.
All right. Trump is not accepted by a majority of Latino voters. But how are his comments and his actions affecting the GOP? And, you know, not all Latinos hate Trump. What are some of the big differences between different Latino groups? All right. So we still talking with Patricia Mazzei. She's a politics reporter at the Miami Herald. Also joining us now, Scott Clement is a polling analyst for The Washington Post. Scott, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
And Julio Ricardo Varela is the founder of Latino Rebels, a blog. Julio, great to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, hi. I'm also with NPR's Latino USA Digital Media Director.
Fantastic. All right. You know what, Scott? I want to start with you. And I wondered, what did this moment do for or against Trump's campaign?
Well, in some ways, we're going to have to wait and see. We haven't seen a lot of polling of Hispanics since that moment, but we know quite a bit about how Hispanics have reacted to the first month and a half or so of Trump's campaign, and it's been very, very negative from the start. This Gallup poll that we highlighted found 65% of Hispanic adults in the U.S. holding unfavorable views of Trump, only 14% favorable. Those are starkly negative, and they're actually quite similar to the views that Hispanic voters expressed of Mitt Romney in 2012. So they ring some alarm bells in Republican ranks of, you know, the dangers of alienating a community that's growing as part of the electorate.
All right, so we hear about what he might be doing, you know, in alienating the Latino vote. But what's he doing to hurt the GOP? What does the Gallup poll tell us there?
Well, it tells us a very different and maybe nuanced story. I mean, for one, a lot of the other Republican candidates are not viewed anywhere near as negatively as Donald Trump. In fact, several are viewed positively, in particular Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. What seems to be behind this is, for one, Hispanics are not very familiar with a lot of these candidates at this early stage. Only about 4 in 10 even have a favorable or unfavorable impression of Marco Rubio, who's had an outsized voice in national politics over the years. And so what this tells us is the first couple months of Trump's campaign have really familiarized and gained criticism among Hispanics for Trump, but that hasn't spread to the rest of the GOP field. And we just don't know where that's going to go yet. But it certainly represents a danger. But I think the Gallup poll showed that it just hasn't infected the image of a lot of these other candidates yet.
And is the I wonder how the GOP is I guess, dealing with, if you want to call it that, or what they think of Trump and his message?
Well, the Republicans at large have a positive view of Donald Trump, and they've grown more positive since he announced his candidacy. They didn't like him very much beforehand. But I think what you're seeing in some of the actions of the party, including in Virginia this last week and trying to get candidates to say they will support the eventual Republican nominee, is indications the party is going to try to resist Trump, or at least get him to commit to only not running as an independent in a general election. So I think there's definitely a dichotomy. Republicans tend to like Trump. Hispanics really dislike him. And it's not clear how that's eventually going to play out in the coming months, but we'll be watching.
All right, Julio, Hispanics dislike Trump, but not really, not all of them, right?
Well, yes. I mean, not all of them. I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that 100% of any group will never agree on something, and that's true in this case. But let's talk a little bit about context here. You know, at the height of 2004, President Bush, Jeb's brother, won with, I believe it was support in the Latino electorate, probably in the 40s, right? And now in 2012, in the days of self-deportation and Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, that number was at 27%. And it was also, you know, a conclusion by many political observers that one of the failures of the Republican Party was that it had its self-deportation moment. And even though Romney said that early in the cycle, and I believe it was during the primary season, it did resonate. Now, moving to Trump in 2016, yes, I mean, let's not pretend that Latinos are jumping for joy at this new presidential candidate. I mean, my sense right now is that if Donald Trump were to run and actually become the nominee for the Republican Party, we would be looking at numbers 10 to 15% of the Latino vote. What has happened, and what I think people are not talking about, is that Trump has tapped into an ongoing anti-immigrant movement that has had its sort of flash moments in the last 10 years, whether it is, you know, or even 20 years ago in the early days of Prop 187 in California, moving to Arizona's state law 1070, and then moving into this whole Central American migrant crisis that happened last year. There's been an underlying current of this sort of go back to your country. This country is becoming more browner, more Latino, more Spanish speaking, and that is seen as a disadvantage. And so Trump has really crystallized that feeling. And people are also not talking about the fact that he led with that when he announced in June.
Right,
when he said, you know, rapists and criminals. And he can say whatever, you know, his campaign can spin it any way he wants, but it is not, you know, Donald Trump is not good for Republicans when it comes to Latino outreach.
I want to focus though now on the Latino voter. And look, we have a long time, obviously, before the nomination, but I want to look at the Latino voter, and I want to look at the differences in different Latino groups. Patricia, something interesting you were tweeting out the other day about a radio program here in Miami. And I think it kind of pointed to some of the differences. And what I'm talking about are differences between, say, the Cuban community to the Puerto Rican community to the Mexican community to the Colombian community. And we have a lot of different Latino communities here. But real briefly, what was it you were listening to?
Well, I was listening to a morning drive time show on a Univision-owned but traditionally Cuban-American stronghold station where the Trump-Ramos incident was being discussed, and it showed that difference between the different Hispanic groups, because particularly in South Florida, you have a big Cuban-American population that is just not affected by the immigration debate like the rest of the Hispanic population in the country is if you're Mexican or Central American or South American, because of the Cuban Adjustment Act, which allows Cubans to spend a year and a day in the U.S. and then apply for their green card, their residency. So
you could just see that contrast in the callers who were calling in and saying they agreed with Trump and they should throw the Mexicans out. And that's very ugly to hear one immigrant group turning against another. But it shows that they're just under very different circumstances, as are the Puerto Ricans in Central Florida, for example, who are U.S. citizens by an ex-Congress. So you're just not affected by the immigration debate the same way if you're a group that is protected by the U.S. and can stay here legally. You know, you have other issues that you have to deal with, but not with getting deported.
All right. And I apologize. We are having a bad cell line connection. We'll see if we can clean that up. And really, I want to put this out there real quickly, is this idea, are there political, social, cultural differences between different Latino groups? We see that a lot here in South Florida because yes. We have so many different groups. But what are some of those differences? And how do you think that's going to play out in this upcoming election? We'd like to hear your thoughts. 800-743-9576. 800-743-9576. And again, what Patricia was mentioning was a Cuban caller making a comment about Mexicans. And so maybe it points out some of this difference. Scott, I want to talk to you a little bit about that, is how candidates approach these differences. I'm coming from Las Vegas, where you had a lot of Mexican Central Americans. Here in Miami, again, a lot of Caribbean. But what's that message? What's the message that any candidate's going to have? Does it change when they're talking to Cubans or Mexicans or Colombians?
Well, I think navigating those differences is one of the challenges for candidates, you know, approaching any community that's out there. And I think assuming that the Hispanic voter bloc is can be treated in the same way, no matter what the national origin is probably a mistake. I think where we often end up talking about groups in the aggregate about Hispanics is more a limitation of data that's out there, and the tendency to group people by different areas of voting. But I think, you know, one thing that's interesting about the Florida dynamic and Cubans, and one thing that was really interesting about the 2012 election was how Obama did better among the Cuban vote than Democrats have historically done. And the gap between the Cuban Hispanic vote and non-Cuban Hispanics, which include in large part Puerto Ricans but also others, was smaller than usual. Typically, Cubans leaned more Republican by a great degree. And that definitely said to me that this is an area where Republicans may be losing some support going forward. And if Democrats can consolidate more of that Cuban vote, that would really benefit them in Florida, a state that was incredibly close in 2012. And so I think understanding those different dynamics really can help candidates navigate the field.
And Julio, I mean, is it about the different where you come from? Is it about if you're Puerto Rican or Cuban or Mexican, or is it your socioeconomic situation?
Yeah.
What are the differences here? I mean, how do you separate?
First of all, I think it's a little bit simplistic, and I'm going to push back on a lot that's being said, because I think that type of analysis might have applied itself about 10 years ago. What you're seeing now, and in the world that I cover, and this is a digital connected world, you're seeing an awareness across different Latino communities in the United States. Yes, there has been socioeconomic and cultural and even racial tension, because no one's talking about the race aspect in all this as well, that has had a history in not only in the U.S. Latino community, but also in Latin America. But now when you see, for example, one of the biggest champions of immigration reform on the Democratic side is Puerto Rican. He's Luis Gutierrez. And you know, Representative Gutierrez is in Chicago and has a very large Mexican contingent, Mexican constituency. You're seeing an awareness in the Puerto Rican community in Central Florida, knowing what's going on in the Southwest, or what's going out in the West, or what's going on in Las Vegas. So the world that I cover really is not reflecting sort of the traditional conventional wisdom that, you know, the Cuban American population is reactionary, or the Puerto Rican population in Central Florida doesn't care about immigration because they're U.S. citizens, or in New York, or in Chicago, or in L.A., or in Texas. It's a completely different world. And I have to say that Donald Trump has kind of crystallized that, and in a lot of ways has brought a lot of this different type of Latino communities, understanding that they have a shared history, a shared culture, a shared language, and that they have more in common, more unites them than divides them. So I'm not ready to say that, you know, Donald Trump is going to get, you know, a very substantial portion of the Latino vote. In fact, what's happening is that he's employing a strategy to say that he doesn't need the Latino vote to win the primary.
And now we always keep hearing about the importance of the Latino vote. All right, real quickly, I just wanted to jump to the phones because it's interesting how the Cuban vote will react, how Cubans will react to what they're seeing in this race. But also, you know, we hear about other groups. And again, coming back to that phone conversation on a radio program, how Latino groups see each other and how they view each other. I want to turn over to Eddie in Coral Gables. Eddie, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much. I have lived in Miami, Brazil, or Puerto Rico since 1968. I have lots of Latin friends, and most of them look with admiration at the U.S., some with envy, but they are very much against and talk ill of the wet foot, dry foot, anachronistic open immigration for Cubans, and even Cubans who have been here a long time are very much now against the economic refugees that are coming in.
That's an interesting point that you're bringing up then, is how do different Hispanic groups maybe in South Florida look at the Cuban community? Patricia, is there something there? Is there perhaps a divide between all of the Latinos and Cubans?
Well, I think to the point that was made earlier about how this doesn't fit neatly into, you know, stereotypical categories, some of the biggest Republicans pushing for immigration reform in the House are Cuban Americans from South Florida. You know, Mario Diaz-Balart, a representative from Miami, is Cuban and certainly doesn't have to deal with him or his community getting deported, but he is a big advocate for immigration reform. And you have someone like Representative Carlos Curbelo, another Miami Republican, who is talking about how the Cuban Adjustment Act needs to be reformed, like the caller said, because all these years later, the refugees that are coming from Cuba are just not in the same political persecution situation that the ones in the 1960s were. So I agree that this doesn't fit neatly into categories and that it has changed over time, clearly, as the U.S. policy towards Cuba has changed and the Cubans in the U.S. have changed, and people's attitudes over time have kind of softened a little bit.
All right. Well, you know, this is a topic that we can definitely cover over the many, many months that we have before the nomination. We have to end it there. Patricia Mazzei is a politics reporter at the Miami Herald. We also heard from Scott Clement, who is a polling analyst for the Washington Post, and Julio Ricardo Varela, who is the founder of Latino Rebels blog, but also the digital media director of NPR's Latino USA. And I want to thank you so much for joining us. And for the callers who were chiming in, remember, you can always find us online. Share your thoughts on today's topic. You can tweet us at WLRN. Find us on Facebook, the group, the Florida Roundup. And we'd love to hear from you and your thoughts. And again, we'll tackle this issue more in the coming months. And that is the end of the program. I want to thank all of our folks here who make the show possible. Again, Julia Dupa, who's the producer, Alicia Zuckerman, also producer of the program, our news director, Terrence Shepard, our digital editor, Maria Muriel, WLRN's program director is Peter Jay, our technical supervisor, Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is coming up next. Thanks for joining us. And remember, keep tuned in to WLRN throughout the weekend. We'll keep you updated on Tropical Storm Erica. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening.